What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was the son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potasnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Reb and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Good morning, I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, there was an unprecedented attack on Israel. Overnight, some 300 missiles, drones were hurled at Israel. A very, very, very difficult situation. I look at this and I say, how did we get to this place? And I think that's something we have to examine. How did we get here? How is it Iran is so strong and has not been contained throughout the years?
So strong or willing to take this level of risk? There are several Rubicons that have been crossed here, Rabbi. Iran firing directly on Israel into Jerusalem. It says a lot about how far they're willing to go. Question is, what are they signaling? What's the message here? How are we supposed to understand this?
Well, I've often felt, as it has been said, that when those say we want to destroy you, they mean it. Iran, for years, has proclaimed its determination to destroy Israel. It's no secret. Hamas, for years, has spoken about its determination to destroy Jews. So I think we have to take them seriously. But I also say, Iran didn't get here overnight. This has been forming over the years. The removal of sanctions, the willingness of other countries to look the other way. Iran should have been strangled economically over the years. We would not be at this point. You know, I go back years ago. I remember when the president of Iran was welcomed at Columbia University. President of Iran, different time, welcomed at the United Nations. We have allowed this monster to come into place. We created the Frankenstein.
What do you think American policy should be with regard to
Iran? I think we have to contain them. I think we have to look back and say we made many mistakes and we can't go on this road again. There should be serious, severe sanctions on Iran. They should not have the capacity to do this. And I think it's not just America. The civilized nations have to come together, form a coalition. We've seen coalitions in the past. There has to be a committed coalition willing to limit Iran in its capacity to go forward. The removal of sanctions, the handing over billions of dollars to Iran was self-destructive. So we shouldn't be so shocked that we are at this point when we contributed or created the problem.
I don't think that Iran wants to go into nuclear war, but I do think that they are sending a message, a very risky message. There was recorded a statement that was made by Iranian government that this closes the matter. What did they mean by that? Well, are they expecting that Israel will not respond?
You know, when you are consumed with hatred, when you have an ideology that says the Israel should not exist, someone says they don't want to go to war. What does that mean? Can you really believe them? I think American intelligence, Israeli intelligence, and really other countries need to come together and say, how do we stop them from going further? It is really a sad commentary that we are at this point. We shouldn't have been here, and we can fault ourselves for allowing Iran the capacity to be here. You know, the other day, there was a demonstration in Michigan, death to America, death to Israel. And I have to say, the Congresswoman from Michigan, Rashida Tlaib, said nothing, didn't condemn it. So I think if you look at this trajectory, we've all contributed to the problem. And now the question is, where do we go from here?
That's a bigger question. Yeah, I mean to cut you off, Rabbi, but that's the big question because, you know, there's now pressure on Israel to escalate again or wind it down. And, you know, that's a tough tension to have to navigate through because if they wind it down, does it say that, you know, they are capitulating to Iranian's position in supporting Hamas and willingness to take this kind of risk and fire what was orchestrated weaponry, Rabbi? This is over 300 rockets. It takes time to put together that sort of attack. It didn't happen suddenly, overnight, impulsively. This was a planned attack. But you tell me, what do you think Israel should do? How should Israel respond?
I know what they should not do. Israel would not allow itself to be the victims of annihilation. We say it's not a mitzvah to commit suicide. It's not going to succumb to passive resignation. I think it's going to do everything it can to contain Iran. We've seen where Israel has been able to penetrate inside Iran and disable the technology. I think you're going to see more of that. But above all, you're going to see an Israel that is not going to lie back and say, let's wait for Iran to do something before we do something. They're going to say, what do we have to do? What's in our best interest to survive as a nation? And I think that's something that we all should support.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're careful here because we don't want a regional conflict. We don't want that. Iran can escalate by going full bore into their nuclear program. You know, we're always concerned about this. We didn't handle it right in the past. And the question is now, what will the Biden administration do? How will the Biden administration respond to this? What are your thoughts?
Look, once again, we cannot be so docile when others are determined to destroy us. And, you know, if Iran attacks Israel today, it also is capable of attacking America tomorrow. I think we have to send a clear message that you will not get away with this. You're going to pay a severe price for this, and we're not going to be the lamb led to the slaughter. But I do think we have to be determined to make sure Iran goes no further with its nuclear program. It's gone too far. As you said, we've made so many mistakes in the past. We shouldn't have been here, and now we're paying a real, real heavy cost for it. You know, we say that some people will feed the alligator because they say the alligator won't swallow them if they do that. The trouble is the alligator is never satiated. So I don't think any temporary measure is going to succeed. I think there has to be a real comprehensive strategy by Israel, America, and other nations who are committed to preventing Iran from escalating this war. We can't go back. We got to go forward.
You know, you reference the speech of the Iranian leader to Columbia University at the UN. And, you know, both speeches made it very clear their feelings concerning the state of Israel and their understanding of what it's going to take to move forward. And that does not include the existence of the state of Israel. Too often, we don't take people seriously when they make these kind of statements. I mean, our conversations, the airways are so filled with rhetoric that we tend to minimize these things when we hear them. I think we need to pay closer attention and stronger attention to these kind of statements, especially with the nation of Israel. Let's talk about the biblical perspective. You of course, a practitioner of Judaism, and your scripture speaks of Israel's place in global history. My New Testament also speaks of Israel's place in global history and global conflict. How much of this do you see and understand from a biblical context?
Look, there's a well-known principle that if someone seeks to destroy you, you have a moral responsibility to destroy that person. So Jewish tradition is replete with many support passages for preventing someone from committing homicide and from you from committing suicide. So I think we're on very solid moral ground here. You know, sanctions do work. And I think we have to really, we have to be very, very serious in our determination to impose as many sanctions as possible so Iran recognizes there is a price to be paid for its behavior. And we have to stop looking the other way. You know, I remember saying on one of our programs, if you are compassionate to the cruel, you're going to end up being cruel to the compassionate. And we have been very compassionate to this cruel regime. We've allowed them to get away with it. And now...
But you're being very specific here in saying sanctions, because there will be those who are wondering, okay, are we talking about, you know, going to full-scale war between Israel and Iran? But what you're saying is implement sanctions. Squeeze them.
Cut them off wherever you can economically. Mm-hmm. Don't allow mm-hmm. them to, you know, to sell their oil wherever they want. There have to be some real limitations. You know, put up those guardrails so they can't do this again. They have to know we will pay a very, very heavy price if we go further with our nuclear program. I think they respect strength, and we haven't exhibited strength, and that is very costly.
There are those who are accusing the United States of not exhibiting strength on this matter as well. What are your feelings about that?
We have not exhibited strength.
Trump is saying, he's already said, weighed in, Donald Trump said, if he were president, this wouldn't be happening. Of course, he says that about quite a few things. Yeah. But do you feel that the United States has been weak?
Well, I can tell you this, during the Trump presidency, there were sanctions, heavy sanctions, that were imposed on Iran, and Iran felt it. They were in a very, very bad place. They were very weak. And then comes a new administration. All of a sudden, policy is reversed. And here we are today. So I think we have to look at what works and what hasn't worked. And we can't allow ourselves to think by closing our eyes to it, by just thinking everybody is a good guy, we all going to get along. This kumbaya, you know, spirit is going to win the day. It doesn't. And I think our naivete or our refusal to recognize reality is something that has boomeranged.
Well, you know, how do you, you know, the challenge is satisfying your constituency without going into a full-scale war. You know, how does the United States do something like that? How does Israel navigate those borders? And even Iran has to navigate those same borders. How do you respond to that,
Right? Well, I think, again, collaboration is the answer. You know, if you look at the taking out of those drones and missiles overnight, Israel did it. America did it. Jordan took out mm-hmm. some of the drones. So, mm-hmm. again, look, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, a host of countries don't want to see Iran advance. It's in their best interest to do whatever they can to contain Iran. And I think that becomes part of the solution so that Israel doesn't have to go it alone. It shouldn't be going it alone. Working together with allies and saying, what is a strategy that is going to prevent this evil regime? They're evil. A regime that's determined to destroy Israel, to destroy America. What is going to be best? What strategy will be best to prevent them from going further? That can only be done when we cooperate with one another and recognize we cannot afford to just allow the removal of sanctions to Iran to do whatever it seeks to do. And here we are today.
Yeah. There has to be collaboration. The international systems have to kick in, especially around trade. When you begin to address the issues economically, you find more cooperation from those nations that are in this kind of rebellion against peace.
And during this whole period now, as a result of this latest attack, we're not talking about hostages. Here we have who knows how many hostages, all kinds of theories as to how many, and they still haven't been released. So you see the cruelty, the barbarism of Hamas, which is supported by Iran, as Hezbollah is supported by Iran. Iran is the octopus with all its different, you know, tentacles, and we have to be able to stop, to cut off those tentacles so we're not at this point ever again.
Yeah, yeah. It raises questions because the willingness to actually fire at Jerusalem. There is the Dome of the Rock. There is a very important mosque there. What does that message send, Rabbi? What message is being sent there that Iran is willing to go that far? To attack their own?
You know, I don't think we recognize the depth of barbarism in some countries. Mm-hmm. I think we think, you know, a handshake, a kind word, signing some kind of document is going to solve the problem. Iran, look at Pharaoh. Pharaoh couldn't be convinced until he paid the most severe price. You look at the enemies of the past and recognize that it takes drastic actions to prevent drastic actions. So I think Iran has to be put on notice and shown that we won't tolerate this.
What's happening within your community here in New York? You know, we have the largest Jewish community in the country.
Yeah. There was a briefing late last night called by Mayor Adams, and Rebecca Weiner, who's the head of the counterterrorism unit, said there's no visible threat, but everybody is on guard. There's going to be police everywhere. But how sad it is, you know, that we have to worry about where we are, where we're going, because the enemy is there and willing to strike. It's a very sad moment. We're going to pray, but we have to pursue a policy that is going to stop this kind of behavior from rearing its head again.
You're a man after my own heart. Prayer with action.
That's right. We have someone on our program that we're going to talk to, not about this situation. He's a friend of ours. He's a rising star in the religious world. I'm talking about Reverend Charles Galbraith. So when we come back, we'll be talking to him.
Yeah, so stay tuned. It's a lively morning, Sunday morning here with you and us, the Reverend and Rabbi on 77 WABC. We'll be right back.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard. Rabbi, today we have a guest who is affectionately known as Pastor Charles. I speak of none other than the Reverend Charles O. Galbraith.
He's Irish?
I want to make sure I pronounce that correctly. He is a senior pastor of Clarendon Road Church in Brooklyn, New York, and was formerly with Alliance Theological Seminary, which was my alma mater. And now he's associate dean and partnering professor. I may have gotten that wrong. He is at Asbury Seminary. Is that correct?
That's correct. Serving as an assistant professor over there.
Okay. Well, leave it to me to just wreck an introduction, but we're going to keep it going because he's also part of the God Squad, Rabbi, at the 67th Clergy Council.
I have no problem with the God part of it. I have a real serious problem with the squad.
That's
you
it.
Know, they got to remove that squad. Yeah.
God, no, don't take that political. Don't go there, Rabbi. Don't go there. Not at all. But Pastor Galbraith has been in ministry in the community, and that's his passion. We were talking about that before the program started and talked about how, and Rabbi, you understand this, that in our Protestant world, especially in America, we have these incredibly influential churches who are doing great things nationally and globally, but disconnected from their local communities. And we share, Pastor Galbraith and I share that belief that, you know, charity begins at home. What we do in our local community then should spread out beyond. Reverend Charles O. Galbraith, thank you for being with the Rev and the Rabbi today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Reverend Bernard. Thank you, Rabbi Potasnik. It's an honor to be here. I also have to let you know that I'm first a fan. I listen to you. And so it's a great honor to be able to be on the program. And Rabbi Potasnik, we predate the other squad, just to put that out there.
Thank God.
Ah,
otherwise, you wouldn't be on the air today with us.
I
have to tell you, Reverend Bernard, when I hear Pastor Galbraith speak, and I hear you speak, and I see the reception you receive at your respective congregations, I'm uplifted. I say there's hope for the future, because you know, when you look at some of the national numbers in terms of declining attendance, it's very depressing. And yet, neither one of you has that experience in your areas.
Well, I'm going to let the Reverend Galbraith respond to that first.
Yeah, so I've been seeing this and studying this, Rabbi, as we see that there is a disaffiliation and disconnection with religious association kind of across the board. But what we have seen, and I'm thankful for Reverend Bernard's leadership with this, is when people have an experience with a grand narrative and an experience with something that is authentic, we see that there is folks coming around to see what's here. Particularly, I think for us, we saw during the pandemic when everything else seemed to be failing, folks who may have disconnected from a faith in our faith traditions really connected and dialed in, as Reverend Bernard said, because not only have we been present sharing the word, but we've also been doing the work. I'm thankful to be able to be a part of that. And I think there is hope. I'm constantly in the space of trying to see how we can see that hope and imagine it and realize it here in Brooklyn and beyond.
You know, Rabbi, if I may, in response to Pastor Galbraith, you know, Pew Research study came out with a look at church attendance in the religious landscape study is what it was called. And they broke it down by race and ethnicity. And what we hear from Pew Research, from Bonner Research, Reverend Galbraith, you're familiar with Bonner and their work, is not impacting the Black church. Mm-hmm. And the Black church is not monolithic, but it's not impacting the Black church in America as much as it is the white church in America. The statistics were in terms of church attendance. Amongst whites, it is now 34%. And with blacks attending church, it's 47% at least once a week. This is at least once a week.
Why the difference?
If I jump in, Reverend Bernard,
I
agree. I actually did see both of those studies, the Pew Research study, as well as the Barner study. While we take a look at those distinctives in regards to the Black church and the white church, some of my research is actually to argue that I think the broader church can learn from the Black church tradition, particularly in regards to its view of sacred text, its affirmation of daily devotion and prayer, as well as its connection towards gathering individually once a week, as we saw those numbers were a bit higher. I think it's particularly in Black church traditions, as you're aware, Reverend Bernard, and also Reverend Fantastic, because you've been in many of these congregations, is this a lived faith. It's not just something that is reflected intellectually, but it's a lived out faith, because people are seeking to understand how in their daily experiences how a faith can be applied and engaged with. And so I like to call it embodied faith, that is not something that we see just for a weekend, but I need this in a continually and consistent way all throughout the week.
That's interesting, because we are having an increasing number of what I call cultural Christians, and Rabbi, you have cultural Jews. Mm-hmm. These are individuals who are identified with a particular faith by virtue of the culture. But in terms of practitioners, another study also done by Pew Research, and Barna did a study as well, shows that Blacks are actually involved in practicing their faith, not culturally, but mm-hmm. like Reverend Galbraith said, on a daily basis. It's a part of their daily life experience. What do you see happening, Rabbi, in terms of the Jewish faith?
So you use the word, both of you use the word authentic. And I was telling some people that in 2023, Merriam-Webster's dictionary said that was the most popular word, the word being searched the most. People are looking for authenticity. They're looking for something that, I think as Reverend Galbraith said, impacts their lives in a meaningful way, not tangentially, not superficially, but has a deeply resonating spirit. And I think you find in the Jewish world, there is that yearning for authenticity as well. There are many who say, I'm not there to hear what the New York Times says. I'm not there to hear, you know, some political story. I'm there to hear what my Bible says to me about issues of the day. I'm there to pray with people who take prayer seriously. So where you find that authentic spirit, where you find that people are talking about the real, you know, they're going through the tradition and saying, this is what the Torah says. And these are the commentaries. That has a greater appeal than just, you know, Judaism light, if you want to call it that. So I hear what you're saying, and I think there is some similarity in the Jewish world. I also think with young people, I think some people have found there is a great void in the secular world.
They can be
successful, but at the end of the day, so what? How do I feel validated? How do I feel that I'm contributing to society if all I'm doing is making a living, rather, some people say, than making a life? I think that's where we share that common bond.
And Rabbi, I think you're exactly on to something. Reverend Bernard referenced a study, and I think in that same study, it talks about the rise of the nuns, those who have no religious affiliation, but they're not atheists, or they're not opposed to faith tradition, but they're searching for something the more. One writer talks about not the irrational, but the more than rational. This idea of something beyond just their daily experience of working and living. And so they're looking and searching. So you hear those terms as spiritual, but not religious. And when I hear that, I hear people who are seeking for something more and something real.
It is true. And they're making that distinction only as a rejection of organized religion, established religious systems. We did, look, I'm a baby boomer. We did it in the 70s. We were anti-establishment. We were calling for radical change. And the 60s, was a decade of every revolution imaginable. But at the same time, as you know, Reverend Galbraith, there was the Jesus movement. There were hippies who were, you know, getting a guitar and, you know, sitting out in the park. And all of a sudden, you had thousands, even tens of thousands at some time, gathering to embrace the faith. So it's interesting how we could have somewhat of, I won't go as far as saying apostasy, but a moving away from what has been established and looking for new ways of understanding and interacting with their faith. And I think that's what these millennials are experiencing. Rabbi, how is it in the Jewish faith?
Yeah, I think the same thing. You know, you and I, Reverend, haven't spoken about value. Give me something of value and I will participate. And people are looking for that spiritual value. You know, they may not be joining gyms, for example, the millennials, but they're hiring trainers. They want something that impacts their lives. And I think when they look at a congregation, they say, you know, I'm here because I want to understand what it means to be a Jew. I want to understand what the Torah says to me about daily living and how I should live in a world that also is not majority Jewish. You know, how do I protect my identity in that world? So I think if you provide people with that enriching experience, if they walk away feeling renewed, refreshed, you have accomplished something that is going to get them to return.
Yeah, I agree with this as well, Rabbi. And I also think that folks are looking, even though they're looking in different ways, they also are looking for our faith traditions to be who we say we are. Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. King has that famous line that he's asking America to be who we say we are on paper. I think that many millennials, Generation Z and Alphas, are asking for us to be who we say we're supposed to be. And I think when we show up in those spaces, as I know both of you have demonstrated and illustrated through interreligious dialogue, friendship, as well as advocacy in times of difficulty, that folks get renewed faith in each other, but also in our various religious traditions.
So you touch on the interfaith aspect of our work. And here we are talking about the richness of our respective traditions. Do you not find that there are those who are skeptical of interfaith relationships because they feel somehow you're going to compromise your identity, you're going to dilute who you are so you can receive the satisfaction or approval of others, that you're not really going to say who you are because you may be, at a state of difference with others. You're not going to agree on things. Do you find that to be so on some level?
I think, to be honest with you, I think sometimes I get that from folks who do not live in New York City. Mm-hmm. I think in New York City, because we are deeply connected, and for many of us who are doing the work to impact folks' lives, we need each other. We are deeply connected to one another. And I think what I try to do and try to model is to fully affirm my faith tradition. I do not try to water it down. I believe what I believe. I affirm what I affirm. I teach what I teach. But I also honor and respect my other brothers and sisters. And when we find that there's places and spaces where we're called to be in agreement on moral issues, I think that, you know, it is one of those writers who says we need a moral voice, but unfortunately, many of our religious traditions have caught laryngitis. When we get our voices together for moral issues that matter, it makes major impact.
No, that is very, very, very true. Do you find that there is a change taking place in churches that at one time were very strict in terms of their own tribe, their own clan, their own group, whether it be denominationally or some fellowship of churches, and they felt that it would be a violation of their doctrine to find common ground with another religious group who may believe things that are diametrically opposed, or in some cases, a degree of difference. Do you find that that's changing, Reverend Galbraith?
I can't speak to everywhere, Rev, but I think it's changing when you have issues and concerns that matter. You guys spoke about the God Squad before, and the God Squad is a group of pastors and other ministry leaders here in Central Brooklyn with the express purpose of ending gun violence here in Central Brooklyn. We come from different denominations, different backgrounds. And when I first came to it, I was like, well, there's an Episcopal church, and this is a Roman Catholic church, and this is an Evangelical church, and a Pentecostal church, and a church with folks from Jamaica, and a church with folks from Guyana. But we had a collective need of violence that was taking place within Central Brooklyn. And so regardless of our various traditions, we had a mission. We had a direction. And so as a result of that, we came together as a coalition to affect and impact gun violence. And we're thankful that to be one of the larger groups in the city to seek to end gun violence. I think that's just an illustration, example of faith traditions coming together from different backgrounds, from different traditions that would many times would be skeptical in regards to their doctrinal positions, but in regards to the sociological practice that is present, they've got to get engaged. And if we don't get engaged, we all going to suffer because we're all in the same neighborhood.
So let me ask you both the following. The intersection between politics and faith, or the faith community, the role of politics within the church, politicians speaking in the church, I also mean the synagogue as well. But from your standpoint, where you are there boundaries? I mean, can you endorse or quasi-endorsement by having someone there, you know, where people know where you stand? Or do you limit it to the issues and not the individuals?
Reverend Galbraith?
Oh, this is good. We're getting into it. But I also have to say I've taken my model from Reverend Bernard. I'm not just saying that because I'm on his show and your show, Rabbi. But I was actually a student to go to his church when I was in seminary to be able to learn and understand how we interact with the powers. I believe that everybody knows their role. Everybody understands and recognizes their responsibility. From my perspective, my position is not to advocate for an individual, but rather to advocate for a community. And so part of that advocacy is to be able to hear information from our elected officials, to support those who are advocating for our community, as well as to call into accountability those who are not. We have, as Reverend Bernard does, have elected officials who are members of our congregation and church. And when there is a particular issue, we champion when they are doing what we believe the community needs to do. But when we find that there are issues and challenges, I just had to do it the other week concerning the migrant crisis, as well as a SUNY Downstate Hospital, we call out the moral clarion voice to say we need assistance and advocacy on this particular area. I believe that it's supposed to be informational. But it also, we're supposed to advocate and be that voice that speaks for those in our tradition, we say, who cannot speak for themselves. To be that one who speaks for the marginalized and those who are disconnected from these various traditions. But I would love to hear what Reverend Bernard has said, because he's been doing this and doing it well for much longer than I.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is when Rabbi talked about boundaries. We set boundaries. We only give each politician 3 minutes to speak. So that is the first boundary that we enforce. We've done the best we can with it, but some of them, I may have to get one of those long shepherd rods with the hook at the end.
Yes, sir.
But I will brief them and tell them, look, I don't want you bashing another candidate or political party. Talk about policies. Talk about the merits of what you do and how you do it. So I've been very, very firm. There's only been one occasion, gentlemen, that I have actually literally put a politician out of my service. And this was about 24 years ago. I gave him the opportunity to share. I'm not going to call any names. Gave him the opportunity to share. And then he sat down on the front row, crossed his legs, and went to sleep. I removed him. I said, out, and had the my security come, and of course he was shocked, later issued an apology. But, you know, we will not be used as a platform to promote their agenda or get across a message. It has to be, going back to our first theme for this conversation, authenticity. There must be an authentic representation of what you bring to the community to make a difference. Reverend Galbraith was talking about his prophetic role. We have a prophetic responsibility to advocate for our communities. And let me say this, Rabbi, so you'll appreciate this. I'm sure Reverend Galbraith understands this because he's part of the Black church tradition in America. The Black church not only has shared faith and shared values that bond us together, but also shared experiences as persons of color living in America. And that experience over the last couple hundred years has really, really caused the church to be a foundation for change, for protection, for guidance, you know, on and on and on. And I think you mirror that in the Jewish community because you experience in a different way the same marginalization and segregation that we experience as persons of color in America.
And we knew that the synagogue was the place where we could find that refuge. The synagogue was the place, you know, historically, synagogues were also a place for lost and found items. If you lost something, you know, you hopefully would find it left by someone else at the synagogue. And it's the same with individuals, lost and found. There are people who feeling so lost because of their experiences, but they know they could find, you know, that safe, sacred space, that support from others when they walked into a house, Jewish house of worship. I know the Reverend has to go. I just want to ask you one last question, if I could.
Which Reverend?
First, Rabbi, I would just always say thank you because you're always giving me extra sermons. Thank you. I'll take it.
Yeah, listen, the Rev does it all the time, but he never gives me any credit. But I know you have to run. You had the opportunity this past week to meet Rachel and John Goldberg Poland, whose son Hirsch is being held hostage in Gaza. You bless them. Talk about, if you could, the impact of that meeting for you.
Thank you for that, Rabbi. I'm still reflecting on that meeting. I really believe it was a sacred space to hear a mother's pain, to hear her hurt, but yet also to hear her hope and her deep abiding faith. What I shared with Sister Rachel was what that experience was for me was deeply religiously educative. It was a moment of a lived psalm. She talked about singing the psalms as she waited and hoped for her son Hirsch's release. And I heard a lived psalm in her speaking, in her sharing. In her care and remembrance of her son. I did have the opportunity to bless them. And our congregation, we have a special time of prayer for our world, our community, and we added Hirsch to that reflection of prayer this week. I was deeply moved by a sacred moment to hear a cry of a mother, yes, for her son, but also for all the hostages that were taken as well as by such generosity and grace by all those who are suffering violence and pain that she lifted up.
Family was most grateful to be surrounded by interfaith leaders. That's what they wanted. They met many of the Jewish leaders, but they said, could we please meet with interfaith leaders? And I was happy to make sure that you were included. Thank you.
I was honored to be there.
And that's what it's going to take, creating safe spaces for healthy discussion and even debate when necessary. You know, the climate of the times that we're in is trying to rob houses of worship from being that safe space, the sacred space. And that's something we all must join hands together and push back against.
Amen.
Reverend Galbraith, it has been, now we've been pronouncing it Galbraith, Galbraith. Is it Galbraith?
It is all of those. Our family comes received it from the South, and so there are different variations. I receive it all. Charles is good for me.
But what is the O? What does the initial O stand for?
Oliver.
Oh, okay.
Of course.
Oliver, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Right? Come on. Of course. Well, it's been great having you on the program. Yeah. Thank you for all that you do locally in your congregation. And my prayer is that congregation continue to grow. And I think you and I can say thank God for that, because there are other congregations across the country that are dwindling in terms of numbers. Mm-hmm. And we're experiencing growth and continued impact on our communities.
His initials is COG. What a cog in the wheel he is, huh?
You see, this is what he does. I write it down. Of course,
no,
putting it all towards his retirement.
You know what? I think people listening to this interview, and let me extend it also to your son, Jamal, Pastor Brown. When they hear these people speak, they say there's hope for the future, that you can look at some of the polls, but that doesn't give you the entire story. So thank you so much.
Thank you for being on the program, Reverend, and all the best.
It was a high honor to be with two folks who not only I look up to, but who model it continually and consistently. And the whole city, we were in a meeting 2 weeks ago, and the whole city continues to look to you as a model of hope for our city. So thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.